The format for this meeting is a 10-minute speaker, our secretary's announcement, a coffee and snack break, and then our main speaker. Our first speaker for tonight is Tony C.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tony.
Hi.
And I'm sober by the grace of God, and I try to live by the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be sober. This is a surprise to me, as it probably is to you. You know, I just came in from Tennessee, and I know a lot of people here that I love very much. And I was just sitting there in Tennessee the other day, of how much you have showed me to love and understand. And when the Hermosa Beach Club was here, I came in there 19 years ago. And I was lost and confused, and I didn't know what I was. And I was bleeding out from ulcers. And I was worrying a whole bunch about a lot of stuff. And you guys told me to keep coming back. And I'm glad I did, because I made a host of friends. And I was out there in that storm, and I've never been out of no place. I used to plan to go to Gardena. And I think of all the things that's going to happen to me on the way there, so I wouldn't go. and I don't know about you, but I've never been one of those that can go anywhere. I didn't ever hitchhike either, because I was afraid one of those lunatics would pick me up. I wouldn't even hitchhike, you know. I've always been a frightened child, so I missed out on life a lot. You know, I lived on hearsay, so therefore, if somebody said something happened to you over there, I wouldn't go. And I read a book one time where a pig had ate this man, so when I went by the pig house, I would look at him very strangely, because I couldn't find out which one really did it. I believe they all became suspects. And that's the way I live my life. So I don't know if you call it a life or just passing through, you know. I remember a man in AA said that he was dying and his life went before him. And he wasn't in it. And I said, boy, I know how he feels. It's that identification, you know, that God, you know you've been there, but where were you? And it's just, I guess, like me, you know, when you're drunk, you take a lot of bennies to stay out to remember what you saw, and next day you don't remember nothing. And I don't know if they worked or not. But I don't have no evidence. It's just like the big book says, I always wanted to get more out of life than life had to offer. And now, as I remember, as I came, and there's people here, Dave, that saw me. You know, a lot of people saw me when I came here, so I can't really tell you that I was doing great. I was on the verge of it. Pretty soon, it was going to get good, you know. And I remember Butcher Joe and all them and Maxine and all the people, they just loved me. Yeah, they knew I was sick. And I couldn't read and I couldn't write. And then one guy, one time I told him, I'm afraid I won't be able to get sober. He says, well, don't worry about it. Mexicans can't stay sober anyway. And I said, well, hell, then I don't have to worry about it now. And it was all those guys, they used to just get on me, boy, I tell you. They used to just make me the treasurer of every meeting, man, and the chip person and everything. Boy, I was working hard at this program, you know. I was becoming a part owner of AA. And they just let me go. And I remember India Margaret, that's the high. She came up one day and she kissed me and she said, we need you here. And I never needed been needed anywhere before. Because my mother left me when I was 7 years old. Religion is man-made and spirituality is God-given. When I tried to join the Catholic Church when I was a little boy, and I learned the prayers, I went to join that church one day, and I got in line, and they pulled me out of line to go in the church, and they said, you can't come in. You're not dressed right. You need a white shirt and a blue tie. Well, hell, if I could afford a white shirt and a blue tie, why would I need God? You know what I'm saying? I buy my own way and my own experiences. And I had those resentments that they talk about. You know, I had that bag full of little things that happened to you on your way to where you're going. And I became a total secret. And I was labeled a shy person. So I acted accordingly. So people used to give me dates because I was too shy to ask anybody to go on a date. That way you don't have to take responsibility for your failures. And you know, and I remember one time I asked this girl for a date, and she said, okay. So I went home and I called her. I felt so good when she said she would. So I figured I wouldn't mess it up, so I called her back and said I couldn't make it. you know, it's ugly to operate that way, but that's what you got to do sometimes. Anyway, when I was about 4 months sober, my wife, my spiritual advisor, asked me to either move out of the house or stop going to AA meetings. And this is the first time I had to make a decision. And I knew I had a problem way before she came along. And I remember Sunday Sam was speaking one night, and I was listening. Because I'm one of those that, right now I don't hear shit, but I move my head like I'm really paying attention. And he was talking about, you know, right after he was born, he was longing for the good old days.
Yeah.
I said, oh my God, I know that guy. And then he proceeded to add to the list, like if he had had a bag of popcorn, a dirty book, and a light, he would have stayed. And I said, shit, you know, how do these people know so much? And I went to the house and I told my wife, you know, old Frank D said that I could get better. He said, if I just go to meetings and work the steps, that my life could change. And she looked at me with this look like, oh shit, you're gonna. She says, well, I'll have your clothes packed when you come back so you can move out. Now, I'm 35 and I'm handicapped by the possession this woman has over me. coming in on his ass, a professional kiss ass. And so I got home that night and she had a cardboard box like this, toilet paper, basic necessity for a Boy Scout. And as I thought about it, I had a horrendous nightmare about my Boy Scout relationship. I was going to go one night to a Boy Scout outing. And I read where a boy had been terrorized by a bear while inside his sleeping bag. And I imagined, how did he get out? And I started hyperventilating. And I went home. You know, because I tell you, I live on hearsay. So the wife packed me out of the house, you know, and I'm going down to this, and I had an old truck, and a lot of you remember my old truck, and I said to myself, God, you'll never be able to pick up a girlfriend with that truck, because I'm walking out of the house. Then I had a and I had a spiritual awakening. Someone told me, go back and kiss the rest and tell you, and you won't go to AA. And another thing says, if you don't go to AA now, the next time, you're going to do a lot of time, or kill yourself, or kill somebody. So I went to my truck, I went to my meeting, and next day my running buddy moved in with my wife. And I'm driving by, and he's with my kids, watching my TV, and he's using my phone. And he's doing those things with my wife that's getting ready to do pretty soon. Oh, man. But they told me, hey, you got to do the opposite of what you've done all your life, or your life will change. So they said, always tell somebody. So I ran up to the club. There's nobody but this guy. And he had a white shirt and a tie. And I thought, oh, I got the president. And so I went up to him and said, hey, sir, could I talk to you, please? He said, yes, may I help you? I said, yes, I feel like killing two people today. And he looked at me and says, that's never happened to me. I don't know what I'd ever do if it ever happens to me. But I love you, and I hope you don't have to drink over this. And he took off. And I said, I'm saying to myself, God, I hear people get up here. Oh, I called my sponsor and I told him I was emotional, and 30 or 40 of them came over to the house and they paid my rent and my phone, and we went to Catalina, and Zoom, I felt better. I said to myself, where in the hell are they now? But you know, relationships don't get you drunk. Drinky does. Relationships allow you to work the steps. And they told me, pain is a touchstone of spiritual growth. I felt taller right then.
Yeah.
You know, and I was able to babysit for them. A week later, they came into Hermosa Beach and sat behind me and said, Tony, could you babysit for us? And they got to put salt in the wound. And I said, yes. And there was a lot of people just came out. Maxine came behind me. I'm sitting right in the front because I didn't want you to see my stomach felt like this. My lips felt like this. And I was in a lot of pain. So I figured I'll sit in the front. Nobody can look at me. And Maxine came behind me, and she goes like this. Pray for him. He needs help. And I'm looking to see who's the one that needs the prayer. And people look at me and say, hi, Tony. What you looking at? You know, that was the beginning of my recovery. You know, and I was able to make amends to that wife and babysit for the kids, and I became his sponsor. Then I gave him a 3-year cake before I left California, and I was ever wishing well. See, because the miracle, I didn't recognize the miracle at the time. And if you stay sober and you will see the miracle, that I was able to learn some self-worth. God don't make junk. I learned unconditional love. I knew I had hurt her very bad, and I didn't blame her for staying with me that long. You hear the Bible says that surpassing all understanding is the love of those people that had not been for their love, we wouldn't be here. And I found out earlier today, in the last few years, that some people didn't stay with us because they loved us. They just didn't know how to get the hell out of the way. And now that there's so many places people get to go on, they don't have to take that abuse. And I'm so grateful for that. So, you know, if you're new and you want to host a friend, see, the reason I'm here is because of Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, my wife's taking an 11-year cake tomorrow at Hawthorne, and what the people did there, they all got together and got us some tickets to fly in from Tennessee for her to take a cake at Birch. You know? And talk about love. It's amazing. I was dreaming about Peggy about 2 weeks ago. In Tennessee, you're not thinking I'd be here, and I love Peggy. See, Peggy has loved me through this whole deal. And Peggy and I have been friends. You know, in AA, you don't just because partners break up, you don't take sides. You just love them because they got to go through their own experience. And we can just love them because it's not easy. And that's what they did for me. And you know, if you knew, I don't have ulcers. I don't smoke at people. I don't have to eat at people no more. I sleep real good at night. I don't jump when the phone rings. I answer the door when somebody knocks. You know? You know, little simple things like my eye ain't winking when I don't want it to. I don't talk with the outer limits like, I'm trying to make more. What do they mean? What do they mean? You know, and if you're new, give yourself a break. Be gentle with yourself. You know, they used to tell me you're sick as your secret. But don't be your own judge and executioner. And hey, we have a loving God that loves you, irregardless of what you've done or what you're going to do. Just keep coming back. And Walter Keyes, before he died, was I heard a lot. There's so many people. I try to carry the legacy of the people that I heard. And he said, thank you, God, for what you have given me. Thank you for what you have taken away. And most of all, thank you for what you have left me. Thank you, and God bless you.
Now, our main speaker will share his experience, strength, and hope with us. Please join me in welcoming Keith D. from somewhere behind the orange curtain.
Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith.
Hi, Keith.
And the most important thing that I can share with you is it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976. And for that, I'm especially grateful. I'm glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So Thank you for inviting me to be here. Thank my wife for riding with me this evening. It's a privilege to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the world is a safer place, and I assume that is because you're here. Even my enemies are glad I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I have a chronic alcoholic mind, which means that I used to drink a little beer and think maybe I ought to do something, and then smoke a little weed and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it, and then shoot a little speed so I had the strength to do it, and then do a little coke so I could be cool when I did it, and then I'd drink some more and forget what the hell it was I was going to do. I don't identify with anybody that's specialized. If you're a specialist, that's fine. I'm a pig myself. I'd do anything, anytime. I'd stick a horse turd in my right ear if I thought I'd get a fix off of it. And some of the people that I drank with said I did that. The only thing I've never done is a pap smear. But there's hope. I'm from Texas, and that doesn't necessarily make you an alcoholic. It gives me certain characteristics that has always enhanced my thinking. I've always had the ability to recognize your character defects and a real need to tell you about it. That made drinking a contact sport for me. I'm not one of those alcoholics that sit around and wait for things to happen. There's people in the world that wait for things to happen. There's people that watch things happen. There's people that make shit happen. And I'm one of them guys that makes things happen. I wasn't one of them guys that leaned against the wall waiting for somebody to come along and give me a drink so we could go out and grab a girl and pat her on the ass and have fun. I brought the goddamn band. I always did. If I were to die right now and God said, we're going to give you a chance to have playback, I'd be on extended play. Because I never missed nothing. I went places and did things. A lot of it I don't even want to remember, but I'm glad I did it just in case I have to review it later. You know, I went all around, up and down. I did a lot of amphetamines. I didn't become a dope fiend. I just did a lot of amphetamines because I was a hyperactive kid and my uncle was a doctor and he gave me amphetamines to slow me down. I don't understand that today. Why don't you give somebody that has an abundance of energy speed? It didn't slow me down, it just put me in neutral so it looked like I was, you know what I mean? But you can hear color and see sound right away. And I developed a real thing for that. It's like going 190 mile an hour with your feet nailed to the floor is what it's like. And, I come from a long line of alcoholics. I don't know that. That isn't necessary. It's not necessary to come from an alcoholic home, lose families, get divorces, lose jobs, go to jail, prison, and kill people in order to come to AA and be an alcoholic, but it helps if you've done all that crap. You know, on a bad day, you got something to draw from. And I did all that, and I wasn't even an alcoholic. I was just about to become one. I don't remember when I crossed over the invisible line. I was loaded when I made the trip, and I don't. My dad's an alcoholic. He's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have 14 months of seniority on him, and I don't ever let him forget that. My dad's a lawyer. I've never resented the fact my dad's a lawyer. I've needed one all my life. I had to get a new one when he got so drunk he couldn't show up for my court case, though. And but he and I have a good relationship today. He's my old man. That's all I ever want him to be, you know, just my old man. And he still lives back in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle, and we have a good relationship because of this program, and you know, no big deal. It's just the book says that, you know, some of those things will happen. I've been with this lady that rode over here with me tonight. We've been together for 34 years, and she had the instructions, and the map book was in the van, and I turned left when I should have turned right, and we went all the way to. You can't go any farther that way on. And she said, why don't you pull in the filling station and get directions? I said, shit. Then they'll know we're lost. And the people behind us, they think I know where I'm going. But I didn't start a fight. I pulled in there, and she went in and asked somebody where. And we made it just on time, just like it was time to pull right up out here. You know, everything looks like it's, you know, in order, you know. And, you know, it is. Everything's in order. I'm right where I'm supposed to be this minute. I'm not a second too fast or a second too slow. I'm right where I'm supposed to be. And the best thing about that is my head and my body's in the same place. And I always check that when I sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it isn't always true. When I sit down in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I check it to see if I'm, you know, if I'm comfortable with being in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm comfortable with being an alcoholic, because that's all I am. I'm just an alcoholic. That's all I ever wanted to be. I didn't know that for many years, but I was working on it. And, you know, I'm grateful for my affliction. I would have wandered around out there stirring havoc in people's lives for many, many years and still be doing it if I hadn't have found out I'm an alcoholic. And I had this problem that people always wanted to, you know, study my behavior patterns. Well-meaning people would lock me up from time to time and ask me why. God, I never knew why. If you knew why would you bother? I mean, I never wanted to know why I did something. I just wanted to did it, and then it was just an experience, and you move on to doing something else. And if I had to figure out why, I would have lost interest in it, and it would have become boring, and I wouldn't have had the real depth of the situation if I knew why. It's always an experiment when you're going through it, and I never knew why, and they always wanted to know why. There's supposed to be some logic in all that, and I never had any logic in it. I just did things, and I went around and around and did a lot of things. By the time I was 19, 20 years old, I'd been locked up for at least a third of my life with well-meaning people trying to discover why. I'd learned, you know, how to please them and give them the order and, you know, tell them what I thought they wanted to know and all those kind of things. I became good at lying. I like to get somebody involved in a conversation that they know's a lie. I mean, they know it's a lie. And you just bring them right in with you, because what they were doing yesterday was so boring that they'd rather be in your lie. And you include them right into it, and their eyes kind of glaze over when you say, "Isn't that right?" And they've just stepped right in there, and then you got them, man. You got them trapped, and you can include them in, and you also have an alibi. And I just enjoyed that kind of conversation. It had depth to it, and I could bring a lot of people into my life, and I needed a lot of alibis, because, you know, I just drank two beers and went to jail a lot. But, you know, I had a lot of fun. I don't deny that. I drank with guys that said, if you get in jail, we'll get you out, and if we can't get you out, we'll get in there with you. And usually they did, too. You know, we were in there. Good old boys. And by the time I was 19 years old, I probably did my first inventory. I got out of an institution down in South Texas, got on a train, called my two very best friends, Oily and Goose, and I said, I'll be into Amarillo in a short period of time. Pick me up because the party's going to start. And I got me a jug of whiskey, and I did that first little fourth step. I kind of looked back on my life, and I said, you know, I've been hanging out with these crazy people. I need to stay away from these crazy people. I need to stay out of these honky-tonk bars and stay away from them crazy women, man. You line 10 women up against that wall over there, and I'll get the sickest one out of the bunch ever time, man. I mean, I just got a thing about sick, crazy women. The crazier they are, the better I like them, you know, because the crazier they are, they don't need to pack to go. They're ready. I got to stay on them fast cars, man. I get in them fast cars, and I get to drinking that fire water, man. I like white lightning, man. I love that, and moonshine, and take a handful of Bennies and bam, I'm down and take a big old quart jar of white lightning and pop that baby, and it'll blow you against the wall. You fall flat on your face and jump up. God, that's the best shit I ever had in my life. I ain't even had time to hit your belly button and come back yet. You know, I mean, it's just, I love the anticipation. I love the adrenaline, the whole deal. My drug of choice in sobriety is adrenaline, you know. And, you know, that's the way I was. And I did that little thought, and I got off the train in Amarillo, Texas, and Oily and Goose was there to pick me up, and they had some 3-2 beer and some white lightning, an old pickup truck with a shotgun and rifle hanging in the back of it, and I did my first fifth step with them. I said, I need to quit hanging around with you guys. And they said, yeah, you get in trouble all the time, you know, and I got to sell them honky-tonks, man. I got to sell them honky-tonks and stay away from them crazy women. And we drove for an hour and a half, pulled up at Wolf Creek. Little Saturday night dance. It was midnight. The band quit playing for a few minutes to have an intermission, and I walked in there and started to fight because it was boring. And the fight got a little out of hand real quick, and so I may be sick, but I ain't stupid. And I took off for the woman's restroom because it looked like I might get my ass kicked. And so I went in the woman's restroom. There was a woman standing by the door, and I said, "Tell me when the fight's over." And I ran in, and pretty soon she stuck her head in and said, "You can come out now, cowboy." And the band was playing, and I asked her to dance. Found out later she finished the fight that I started. I'm a quick study and one quick dance. I found out she had a car, a place to stay, and I fell in love. And I said, "Where you been all my life?" And she said, "Where you been all my life?" And I said, "Well, I just got out of the penitentiary." And she said, "Well, I just got out of an unwed mother's home." I said, "Hell, we deserve each other, you know." "Stick with me, baby. I'll take you places you never been before." I did, too. Most of them she didn't want to go, but hell, I took her anyway. You know how we are. And we set out a life of rip-roaring insanity, absolute total. I'm a violent drunk, physically violent. Now, I won't debate with anybody whether or not verbal abuse is worse on your victims than physical abuse, but I do want you to know I was talking to you when I was beating the shit out of you. I give it my best shot, you know. But me and this lady set up a relationship that was founded on violence. We just we couldn't make love unless we beat the hell out of each other first. You know, they nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer, you know what I mean? And just crazy, just absolutely crazy. We did that for 2 years and then got married. Because sick women always give you an ultimatum. "If you don't marry me, I'm going to kick you out." So what the hell, I had nothing going. I sure. She said she was pregnant and I was the father, and I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over the invisible line. And I knew nothing about those kind of responsibilities, and I ended up with a wife and a kid and a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated my ass and a cat that scratched me all the time, and I lived in the midst of a neighborhood that was absolutely insane. And after a period of time, alcoholics have to do what we call in the AA geographics. Well, I had to get out of Texas, and at that time we didn't call it a geographic, we called it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And I loaded up everything we had and all this stuff in a station wagon, a trailer, and we headed for California because a guy named Lion Shorty offered me a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach, and I didn't have sense enough to know that was ocean. Hell, sounded good to me. I got a load of amphetamines and a bunch of beer, and we took off for California. Most people could have made the trip from where we started in 3 days. It took us a month, you know, and sightseeing along the way. By the time we came across the California border, the 120-pound German Shepherd dog was lean and mean, and he was hanging around the back of my head periodically, drooling over the back of my neck, and when big trucks would go by, he'd chase them along the windows of the station wagon to the back and run his nose into the back window of the station wagon, fall on the cat. They'd have a dog and cat fight on top of the kid. The old lady started whacking and bitching, and I just kept drinking one day at a time. I found a drunken uncle that found me a house to live in as soon as I got here. A hell of a deal. And I moved in to a little shack nobody lived in for a couple of years. And it was a motorcycle gang lived on one side of me and a bunch of hippies lived on the other side of me. You know, I understood motorcycle gang because I drank alcohol until I achieved pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, bought myself a bag of dope and a Harley and became a legend in my own mind, you know. But I never seen no hippies down in Texas. Them cats were dropping LSD, taking their clothes off and laying in the front yard watching the sun come up and go down. You know, that was new. But I had to leave Oil and Goose when I ran away from Texas, and there was a couple of dudes next door at the hippie house, the Doc and Professor. And yeah. I figured, you know, I can pick right up on them. They'll have all the answers to all my questions. I went over there and I asked them, you know, "I'm having trouble when I drink. I'm going to drink this fire water, I go crazy." And they said, "Maybe you're an Indian." Well, my granddad was an old Indian fighter. He fought with my grandma for years, and she was Indian, so, you know. Well,
shouldn't drink fire water. And I said, what am I going to do? And he said, you should smoke tie sticks. What do you do when you smoke tie sticks? Oh, we hang around the park and wait for the ice cream truck to come by. Shit, I always wanted to rob the ice cream truck. I didn't. But I figured, you know, I'm an Indian now. I got a reservation, so if I ever need to do anything, I can revert to tie sticks. And it's crazy all the time. I'd go away and do my thing, come home to rest, and it was like, you know, my life when I came home was like a combat zone. I mean, it's like, you know, I always brought these people with me that didn't want to go home and fight with their old lady, so they'd come and watch me fight with mine. They're always standing behind me saying, get her, you know, and my wife started carrying a 12-inch butcher knife around, always slashing and stabbing, and I like guns myself. And guns will get your attention. They slap her upside the head with a 44 mag and bam, right beside her ear, you know. She can't hear nothing, but she'll pay attention to you, you know. Stick her knife right in my stomach, and I'd stick my gun right on the end of her nose, and she'd say, you go first. And I said, you're goddamn crazy. If I shoot you, you're going to die. And she said, yeah, I know, but the bullet will knock me back, and when I go back, the knife will go forward, and it'll gut you. You know, there's Oriental warriors that train all their life to have the last kill. They're willing to give their life to have the last blood, and a pre-Al-Anon knows that intuitively. Yeah. I don't have to train. I didn't know that. I used to pride myself in being able to choke somebody right to the brink of death. You choke them right up till their eyes glaze over. I used to get her and hold her down. Just choke her right to that point. And, you know, all she ever wanted was 100% of my attention. And she knew that when I was choking her like that, all I was thinking of was her. She was getting off on that shit. If I'd have known that, I wouldn't have done it. And we used to have a little, you know, maintenance program. I used to come home and decide maybe I'd do the chores around the house, you know. And I you know, the book talks about some of us, you know, drink until you think we'll pass out forever. And then the next morning, whoa, we wake up and search madly for a drink, you know. And I'd wake up in the morning, run out in the kitchen, put about 100 mini bennies in the blender, some orange juice, a couple of raw eggs, you know, bam, little breakfast of champions, pour myself a big shot of tequila or vodka and hit it a couple of times with some Tabasco sauce, call it a Bloody Mary. Pound that down, have an intuitive thought like maybe I should go mow my front dirt. And I'd go out in the garage to get my lawnmower. It's always the thing out there that grows and glows because it's made up of four or five different lawnmowers. You know, it's kind of a thing over there, you know, and you get that out in the front yard early in the morning to mow your front yard. And I had weeds and dandelions and rocks and stuff growing in my front yard. And I didn't need a grass catcher because I didn't have any grass. I was always going to make dandelion wine, so when I had all these dandelions out there, when I mowed my front yard, it was just a cloud of stuff floating all around, and all the people on the other side of the street, the Christians, would just go crazy because their dichondra was going to get some dandelion dust on it. I tell that guy across the street, you know, someday I'm going to shoot my lawnmower and plant it in the front yard and cover it with green concrete. I never did get that done, but my mower died one morning, and down in Texas, if your horse breaks its leg, you just shoot it. So I just blowed a hole in my lawnmower with a 44 mag. That's a spiritual experience if you got the right load on. And I'm watching this thing die, contemplating its funeral, and the cops come and want to run my head into their nightstick five or six times out in the front yard, and then she'd come out and go crazy and scream and yell, he ain't mowed the damn yard yet, you know, don't take him away. And the cops would put the handcuffs on her, and I'd say, now you got it right, get that crazy woman out of here, we'll all be all right, you know, and then the cop would say something rotten dirty about me, and I'd have to hit him because nobody talks bad about my old lady but me. Take the handcuffs right off her and put them on me, and then take me down to jail. She'd come down and write a hot check to get me out because that's her job. And then I'd come home and sink into a depression because what goes up's got to come down, and I'd get me a bottle of Red Mountain wine and some Reds and lay down in a recliner in there in the room, and her and the kid and the dog and the cat would line up on their line of contempt over there and look at you, and all the whoever they could drag in, come in, look, he's sinking. I get my old grandpappy's Winchester 97 shotgun out from under the chair and jack her back, stick the barrel in my mouth, and click the trigger. It was empty, of course, because you don't want to shoot yourself unless you got a big crowd. And one time I ran that thing back and I seen some red go by. I thought, I wonder what that was. Of course, that bitch put a shell in that gun. Went off right by my ear, man. I couldn't hear it for a week. It blew the window, the air conditioner out of the window, and the neighbor had been over there to kill him, you know. Cops come, run my head into their nightstick 5 or 6 times down the front yard, you know, and bring the I Love Me Not sports coat that ties in the back, you know. Hard to be cool, flat-ass naked in the front yard in a straight jacket, but you can't overcome that if you... crazy enough, and I'd run around out there and bang my head into the door of the cop car and get some blood, you know, and snot and hiss, and they'd take me down to the nut ward and study my behavior patterns, and they'd give me a little card that I was crazy, that I could come back anytime, save the ambulance ride and let myself in, you know. I mean, hell, there ain't no doorknobs on the inside of those doors. I'm not stupid. And but it did, that card did impress the people I drank with. I became a card-carrying nut. They nickname you animal or psycho when you do that, and I don't know which is a step up, but I was tripping along, and I found myself standing in front of a judge, and the judge was talking to me about me, and he had the right guy, and he's talking to me about doing time, and I didn't want to do any more time. And so somewhere in a conversation with my parole officer, they suggested I go to AA. I'd never heard about AA, and I wasn't afraid of AA. I didn't want to go to the penitentiary again, so I said, well, I'll go to AA. And I didn't know what it was, you know, and I made a contact, and the guy come and talked to me, and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to tell you, I haven't drank since. But the reason I went to that meeting is because at 8 o'clock, she came over with her butcher knife, and the cops had taken all my guns away, and she said, get up. I said, where are we going? She said, we're going to the AA meeting. And I got up and got in the car, and she pulled up in front of the AA meeting, church thing like this, AA sign out in front. She said, what time is the meeting over? I said, it's over at 10. And she said, tell you something, Ace, if your ass comes out of that door 410, I'm going to gut you. Now, you can keep a guy like me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You got a crazy woman circling the perimeter with a 12-inch butcher. I'll stay in the room, man. But I wasn't an alcoholic. I mean, you ain't an alcoholic. You ain't really an alcoholic. You're not really, really. I mean, by God, really an alcoholic. And if you ain't an alcoholic, you can count all the little squares and all the little runners and all the little lights that are on and all the little lights that are off and all the hairs on the back of the people's head in front of you and all the hairs on whatever else you want to count, and the time goes on, and the time just seems like, you know, this is, you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you ain't going to hear nothing except maybe things like, we won't guarantee you've had your last drink after tonight, but we'll guarantee you after tonight you'll never enjoy another one. God, where'd that come from? You know, I heard that. I filed that away. And after 4 months of not drinking or using, not doing nothing but sitting around, I had earned trust, and I did another little inventory, and I looked around. The old dog's laying next to me, pat him on the head, the cat's in my lap purring, the kid's over here, pat the kid on the head, and the old lady's in the kitchen. I'm back in the big bedroom, beat the deal down at the courthouse, and I thought to myself, self, you have prematurely gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I know I'm going to be there someday, but I'm going to be old. Yeah? Yeah. So I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. A strange thing happened to me when I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. I got drunk immediately. Boom. My life changed. It never gets better. It always gets worse. And after it gets worse, it gets worser. And, Jesus, nothing worse than being out there with a head full of AA and a belly full of booze, arm full of dope. I mean, it just drives. You know you're a goddamn loser then. You don't have to go to AA for them to tell you. You know? You know it. And it just, the anger and the violence and the rage inside of me just ran rampant. And the book says it's supposed to tell what it used to be like, what happened in a general way, and what it's like today. And what happened to me the next 4 years of my life, I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, more out than in, and the violence and the you just give up. You know, you can take everything away from a human being, they'll still be a human being. But once you sell your soul or lose your dignity, you got nothing left to lose. You're as near an animal as a human being can be. And I know what it's like to live like that. And I know what it's like to stand in my kitchen, take a drink off a bottle of vodka, and look down a hallway. A little 9-year-old girl stands at the end of that hallway. She's got her chin on her chest and her hair's in her face. She didn't run down there and get me around the leg and say, Daddy, come play with me. She just looked at me. And I turned around and I had to take a drink because physically I had to have a drink to live. Physically I had to have a drink to live. Physically, I had to have alcohol and narcotics in me to live. If you think this is a thinking program, I beg of you, go back to some point in your life when physically you did not have a choice, that you absolutely had
to have something to drink or use. And then you understand the physical craving that we talk about here. There was absolutely nothing I could think of that would stop that. Standing in my bathroom early in the morning, drinking peppermint schnapps, cooked up a load of speed, cut off my arm and stuck that needle in my arm, because I'm the kind of an alcoholic the book talks about, a real alcoholic. A real alcoholic is insanely drunk most of the time. A real alcoholic's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. A real alcoholic will use sedatives and narcotics to calm our nerves and enhance our thinking and drinking. At 9 o'clock, maybe early in the morning, I'm standing in the bathroom and I look in the mirror just for a second, and I saw a reflection of a little 10-year-old girl looking through the hole in the door in that bathroom where I probably stuck my foot. And just for a second, just that long, I looked at that little girl in that reflection, that mirror, and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, this shit's got me, man. I don't have a choice. I don't have a choice anymore. It's got me. And I turned around and I did what I had to do, because that's what I had to do. I didn't have a choice. You know, it's an amazing thing. Kids, animals, family, loved ones, neighbors. It gets to that point. If they're around us and we're drinking or using, they know when it's working and when it ain't working. When it's working and when it ain't working. And that day, looking in that mirror, my little girl didn't say, "Daddy, what are you doing? Please come play with me. Don't beat me and Mommy." She didn't say nothing. All she wanted to know is which direction I was going, so she'd go the other way. And I turned back around and I did what I had to do, because I had no choice. And when I looked back in that mirror, she was gone. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was just what I thought I was. And I no longer have a choice. Being the very best father I could be, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, needing a drink, gotta have a drink, got to have a drink, got no choice, gotta have a drink. All's on my mind, I gotta have a drink. I crawl out of the back of that house on my hands and my knees. The only money in that house was in my daughter's piggy bank, and there under her bed. I crawled down the hallway and I went in there and drug her raggedy and piggy bank out from under her bed, and I broke it on the floor in her bedroom. And a big-time Charlie like me, I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, and the quarters. Because I ain't going to take no pennies down to Connections House or the liquor store. I'm going to be flashing silver when I go. I don't know about your kind of an alcoholic, but when I'm at worst, my kind of alcoholic has eyes in the back of my head. And separating that change that day, I sensed somebody's watching me. I looked over my shoulder, a little 10-and-a-half, 11-year-old girl's hiding in the closet behind me. She got a black eye and a busted lip. I'm pretty sure I had something to do with that. On any given day, it could have been me or her mother, stone cold sober, that gave that to her. She hid in that closet that day because she couldn't go to school. She couldn't go to school because of shame. No. We'd long gone past shame. I hear people here talk about shame. There's some place that this disease will take you, a gray zone where you can go and live where there is no shame. There's only hate. And that little girl knew better than go to school that day, because she'd gone to school that day looking like that. The cops would have come and got Daddy and taken him away, and that wasn't so bad, because then the family gets a rest. But Daddy gets out. When Daddy gets out, he comes home. And God help you if you've hurt me. And being the very best father that I could be that day, I give that kid a break. Can you imagine that? I give her a break. I let her shoot out behind me without inflicting any more pain in her life. I give her a break, a big-time Charlie like me, because you see, at that point in my life, when you catch me in those pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing situations, absolutely necessary for me to inflict some kind of pain on your life that overshadows the memory of what you saw me doing. And I give that kid a break. And we live like that, not a day or a week or a month. We live like that for the next 4 years, day in, day out, day in and day out. There is no time. There is no time. But I'm going to tell you something. If you're sitting in this room tonight, I want to tell you something. If you can sit in this room tonight and you can even imagine the horror and the terror of living that way, maybe even some of you came from that kind of a home, but I can assure you this, some of you are going there, because we ain't all going to make it. But if you can sit here tonight and imagine the terror of that kind of living, then I beg of you this, don't cheat yourself. Don't cheat yourself. Because if you can imagine that kind of pain, then imagine this. Imagine this. Tonight, this very moment, that lady sitting there next to me, we've been together 34 years. She come out of that hell. She's my wife, my lover, my very best friend. And she ain't my sponsor. I'm grateful for that. That little girl sitting in that closet that day, that little girl sitting in that closet that day is a beautiful young lady. She's 30-some years old, 30 years old. She lives in Milan, Italy. For the last 7 years, she's lived in Milan, Italy. She's a model, a ramp model. She models for some of the greatest clothes designers in the world. She loves her daddy. She's forgiven her daddy. And I've forgiven me. She's modeled at the greatest fashion shows in the world. And she's happy to be who she is, and she's satisfied who she is, and she's looked beyond where others would fear to go, to be able to achieve a dream. So if you can sit here tonight and you can imagine the terror and the bewilderment that this disease will take you, then for God's sakes, don't cheat yourself out of the good things that it'll give you. Because what it has given me is beyond my wildest drunken dreams. What it has given me is something that I couldn't even imagine. I could not even comprehend it. Over 17 years of this deal, I haven't cheated on that lady in over 17 years, nor have I wanted to. It has not been necessary for me to beat her. It was necessary for me to stay sober. I had to quit beating the people around with me. I had to quit cheating on the people around with me, and I had to quit drinking and using. It wasn't just a simple don't drink. Because when I came here, I'd been 4 years in and out of here lying and cheating and stealing and jiving and conniving. And when I came here, May 11, 1976, I had to do it all. I had to do it all. Or I couldn't stay sober. And I knew that. And I had absolutely no idea what it was going to take. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I owed over $200,000 to people you don't send them a letter and say, I'll pay you $100 a month. There was two different groups of people had a contract on my ass, and I had this crazy woman that was trying to kill me all the time, and a kid that run around hissed like a wounded animal, and you know, the whole neighborhood was insane, and I ended up detoxing, and I didn't know what to do. A guy came and said he's my sponsor. He said him and the old timers drew straws, and he lost. I said, what's a sponsor, a friend? And he said, no, if you want a friend, get a dog. And I had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated my ass. You know, I didn't know what to do. I said, okay, great. You know, and he come and got me in this detox after I went through shake and bake. Why he come and got me, and he took me home. And I went up the door, knocked on the door, and I said, I got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do, bitch? He said, oh, I've been going to Al-Anon. The kid's been going to Alley Teen. The dog's been going to Alley Dog. And the cat's been going to Alley. What are you going to do, dummy? I said, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. And I waited for my sponsor to come and get me, and I started going to meetings with my sponsor, and he had an old van with a bunch of newcomers in it with nothing inside of it, just a strip van. He had orange crates in there, and he'd take off in the light, and we'd all slide to the back, and he'd stop, and we'd all slide to the front, you know. He did that about the three times the first night I went with him, and I slid up his side and said, you know, I beat a man to death one time for less than this shit, and he just took off, and I went to the back, you know. I have no idea what. You know, and when I came here, I had a long hair down on my ass, a long beard, and I hadn't bathed in a long time. I had a pickup truck that went down the road crooked, and a Harley Davidson that wouldn't start, you know, and I didn't wear underwear or socks. I was just crazy, and, you know, they told me, you know, you got to clean up and suit up and show up and all that shit. And he took me down, you know, got me this suit, you know, one of those smiling Frankie Gordon pinstripe suits. And they got me these green underwears. They wear these 3 days, turn them inside out, wear them more 3 days. And on the seventh, do your laundry, you know, and they give me these socks, you know, wear, you know, and a pair of them funny little shoes, you know. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. I, you know, got rid of my pickup and bought me an AA car, a big Lincoln, big Mark IV Lincoln, anything. An AA car is something with less than 100,000 miles on it. Big Mark IV Lincoln, parked it out in front of the meeting so the newcomers would have hope, you know. Stand around in the meetings, radiate hate, man. This cop gave me a grenade. Bob the cop from Covina gave me a grenade. He said, man, the best, closest thing you're going to get to truth is if you put this in your mouth and pull a pin. I stand around and radiate hate with my grenade, and I stand in the corner of that old Anaheim Milano Club, and my sponsors stand on the other side, you know, and when newcomers would come in, he'd get them and bring them over there, you know, and he'd point at me over there, you know. And I asked one of them newcomers one time, what did my sponsor say about me? And the guy said, your sponsor said, if I go out and drink, I may end up like you. So you're as good as you're ever going to be, you know. I just hated him. I'm going to run over the son of a bitch in the parking lot, you know. And I had so many guns on me that if you'd have bumped into me, it'd look like a mushroom cloud. I mean, I just said, I went to a men's stag meeting. I like men's stag meetings because they talk my native tongue profanity. And I'd say, rant and rave, and somebody'd talk some sick crap out, and I'd say, oh, man, you deserve to die. And I'd take my gun out and take a bullet out of the gun and write the guy's name on the bullet with a Pentatel pen and hold it up and say, I'm going to kill you right off the goddamn meeting and put it there. After the meeting would be over, I'd forget who I was going to kill first, and they'd stand up and hug you. Everybody's hugging around here. Come up, hug you, and you get that tingling sensation. You didn't know whether the hell you're supposed to divorce her and follow them. I didn't know shit. And I think, well, I'll come back next week and throw the grenade in there, for Christ's sake. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was crazy. I didn't sober up and everything's wonderful. I sobered up and every goddamn thing was crazy. My whole world. The book said waves of the past would roll over your ass. What do you expect? Oh, God, I had to go borrow money from a guy that hated me. And, you know, he told me if I missed a payment, he'd kill me. I said, what the hell? There's two other groups of people who want to do that, too. So I bailed myself out of some of that stuff, and I just went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I tried to work the steps. I did an immoral inventory. You know, I mean, if men and women drink for the effect is after some amount of consumption, you can't distinguish the difference between true and false, right or wrong. That's the definition of a sociopath. And then when you're new, they say, do a moral inventory. Yeah. I don't even know what the hell morals are, you know? Do a fearless inventory. I was riddled with fear. I wrote 157 things down on a piece of paper, gave it to my sponsor. He reduced it to 10 in less than 10 seconds and said, here, you're not that complicated. I wrote number 11, all of the above at once. And I know fear because it's been my partner all my life. See? I drove fear like a fast car. Some people fear demobilizing. They hunker down the corner like a mule. And then there's those of us that drive it like a fast car. And I knew that. I knew those things. And I didn't know what to do with it. And I tried to do those inventories, and I didn't know what the hell to do. I did a sex inventory, and they told me to make amends to a herd of sheep and quit kissing them cows on the lift, you know? And I was standing around Anaheim Alano Club over there, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. I didn't know if I was walking or riding a bicycle, you know, Frank or Ernest. I didn't know what the hell. And just crazy. I had no idea what the hell to do with this thing. It was just like it was about to implode. I can't beat on people anymore. I can't do all this stuff anymore. You know, and I'm just sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd listen to, oh, everything's wonderful. Jesus. My ex-wife just sent me plane tickets to come back. And I think, what the fuck? I'm sitting here, I'm dying. I'm goddamn dying. What are you going to do? You need a spiritual experience. Yeah, right. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, alcoholics like me would move into an orgasm and take up residency if we could. You know, I mean, it's a fix. I didn't know what the hell to do. And I'm sitting there and I mean, God almighty, what am I going to do? I knew it worked for you, but it's just never going to get no better for me. This is it. This is it. This is it. I worked all the steps. This is it. 3 years sober, I'm dying. Dying. I'm bleeding to death. And when it took me to the hospital, I pumped 9 pints of blood back in me because I'm goddamn dying. Because I'm my own judge, jury, and executioner. On any given day, I can sit there. Yeah. Right. And I just resigned to the fact that I'm dying. I'm going to die in AA. You know, the old serenity prayer. I mean, I'm going out, you know, any minute. And I was standing there and I looked around, the goofiest looking shit you ever seen in your life walked up next to me and had it sticking out everywhere, man. He wasn't short enough to be a midget or tall enough to be a man. He had welder's cap pulled on weird over one ear, and he had a pair of shorts on, and he painted his feet black so it looked like he had socks on. I recognized that. He beat the laundry deal, you know. And he looked at me and said, will you be my sponsor? I said, Jesus. I can't
can't even take care of myself, for God's sake. You know, what the hell am I going to do with this? I'd seen him the night before in a meeting. He was the treasurer of the meeting. They asked for a treasurer's report, and he said, I stole all the money and I ain't paying it back. And them fools said, you got to keep doing it, Jay. Do it right. I said, here, hold my grenade, you know. I went over to my sponsor. I said, see that guy over there? And he said, yeah. I said, well, he just asked me to be a sponsor, man. I don't know what to do. What do I do with him? He said, you go back and tell him you'll be his sponsor. I said, because I sent him over there. Sponsors never make any sense, and they always tell you to go do crap that they're afraid to do. And if it works for you, they try it. I know that, you know. He said, you go back and say you'll be his sponsor and do exactly what he says. And that don't even make sense to me today, you know what I mean? But I didn't argue with him. I went back and told that guy my sponsor. He says, I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? And he said, I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln. He said, you go out that door, I'll go out this door, I'll meet you out there. And he said, no, I want to go with you. And he grabbed me around the arm. We went out. As we got by the door over there, well, two guys I knew said, boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. That's my new sponsor. Jesus. I got him in the car, and he started talking sick shit to me, and then he said, you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah. A couple things like that, and I started telling him all my stuff, and he said, you're sick, man. You are sick. We need a meeting. I said, we're going to a meeting. Cool it. You know, we go to a meeting. We sit over there. Then I have to explain to him what the speaker said, because that's why you take them to speaker meetings. I knew that. And I'd explain all this religious shit, and he'd say, I did this. And he'd tell me all some sick shit. Then he'd say, you ever do anything like that? And I'd say, yeah. Matter of fact, some of his stuff was so sick that I kind of had to stretch the truth on mine. One morning I picked him up, and he said, you know, I know what you told me last night was a lie, because it's physically impossible to do what you said you did. Yeah, but I'm from Texas. Besides that, I stood on my head. You know, and the guy, you know, I mean, I didn't know. I just driving me crazy, and I have to go ask my sponsor, you know, well, this crap, and look it up in the book and come and tell him. And the guy showed up at my house and had a big book with paper stuck in it. And God, I want to work the steps like you did. Oh, my God, I know I did it. Get in here quick. You know, I got him in the house, and, you know, that's the first step, says we're powerless, and I know we are. I know I am, because you're in my house. It says, my life's unmanageable. I'm sure of that, because it looks like you're going to be here for a while. You're crazy, and I understand you, so I guess we're on step three. You've got to get on your knees and do third step prayer in that book, you know. And I got on my knees, and he cuddled up next to me, and I got that tingling sensation again. Jesus, you know, and I did that third step prayer with him. You know, the cat walked by and looked at us weird. I figured, man, if the old lady sees me on my knees down here in the kitchen with this weirdo, she's going to know I've whacked out for sure, you know. And he jumped up and said, I want to do my fourth step. I said, you got to have that done before you get to your sponsor's house. And he said, no, I can't write. And he threw some papers in front of me. He said, how about if I talk and you write? And he started talking. And I started writing his shit down, you know. Did you ever do anything like that? And I said, sure. And I started writing some stuff down. You know, a couple of things popped up. I forgot to tell my sponsor when I did my fourth and fifth. And I thought, what the hell? God's in here. He can't read or put a little of my shit in his. You know what the hell? That's what it's all about. Get it out. You know, we burn it. He jumped up and kissed me on the cheek and said, I love you. And I thought, well, shit, that's it. You know, I know I'm in love with him now, you know. And don't make any difference whether you're pitching or catching. You're still playing ball here, you know. I didn't know. I mean, hell, I had to walk through all those emotions. I didn't come here and know what's right. I didn't find your sexuality. Get on your knees with a dipshit in your kitchen and do the third step prayer, and it'll tell you what sex you are. And I, you know, I didn't know. I had no idea. I mean, when I sobered, I didn't know if that lady was my bondsman, my nurse, my mother. She played all those roles. I had no idea. And I literally fell in love with a man, because I had no idea what love is. See? I had no idea. If you said you loved me, I just knew that meant I was next. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you showed me what love was. You showed me that love is transparency. You heard it earlier. Transparency means I let you see in. And if I let you see in, I can see out. I'm as sober as I am secret, which means there is no gossip, baby.
Because I got no secrets. People tell me, we don't gossip around here. There is no gossip, you got no secret. See? There is no gossip, you got no secret. And that guy, I let that guy see in. And I was patient. I was patient. I was tolerant with him. And I listened to his stuff, and I didn't love him any less for what he did. I loved him more, man. I loved him more. I couldn't understand it. It's the first time in my entire life that I went for 3 or 4 hours there that afternoon and never thought about me. I was concerned for another human being. I was like an ingrown hair, man. I mean, you could be standing on my foot and I didn't even know you were there. And yet, you know, I sat there that day and I listened to that guy's stuff. And I believed that there was something happening. I know it is in forgiving that we are forgiven. I know it is that we must give away what we cannot keep in order to receive what we cannot lose. It's all a paradox, and I know that today. I know sitting there listening to that guy that day talk about things that he felt guilty for. I'd done the same thing and never had the slightest thought of guilt, or much less the feeling. I thought, my God, this guy's hurting over doing these things. I did the same things and never even hurt. I've listened to enough Fifth Steps now in over 17 years that I've been given a conscience simply by listening to your pain and learning to feel my own. I know the difference between right and wrong today because I'm aware of the consequences. I'm aware of the consequences. I don't want to do the things that I used to do. I can't do the things today at 17 years that I could do at 7 or at 10 or 12 or 15. I don't even want to. My life's beyond anything I ever imagined because of this program. You know, when I was new, I heard a story, and I always like to close with some kind of a story because I ain't real good about talking about God, but I can share with you some things that I come to understand. This little boy lived on a farm. He lived there all his life, 5, 6, 7 years old, you know, and one Saturday afternoon, a beautiful afternoon, the sun was shining, and he's standing out there in front of the house, farmhouse, with his daddy. The little town, maybe 4 or 5 miles from town where they lived, there was a farm-to-market road went right by that house and a big red barn on that farm. And a beautiful place. And the little boy lived there all his life, never knew anything different. He'd seen all the farm animals, all the things. He'd seen all that. He grew up with that. He loved his daddy. And standing there that Saturday afternoon, a dude come whipping down that road in a big old Buick automobile, whipped right up in the front yard, and the guy got out and went up and talked to the farmer. The little boy stood back and watched. And some money changed hands, and the guy backed that Buick right down there against that barn, opened the trunk of that Buick and got this stuff out and started putting it on the side of this barn. The little boy had never seen anything like that, so he meandered down there and started watching this guy. And what evolved was a poster. Maybe some of you have seen it. Maybe it was Ringling Brothers, Barnum Beatty Circus. I don't know, but it was a poster of a circus coming to town, and they put it right on the side of that barn so that everybody went to town on that road would see it. Little boy stood there in total and complete awe because he'd never seen beautiful people in their beautiful costumes. He'd never seen the animals like that before in his entire life. He was totally awestruck, and he ran back up and he told his daddy, "What is that? What is that? Come and look." And the daddy went down there being a good father, explained to the little boy, "That's a circus. That's a circus, and it's coming to town. And if you work hard and you're a good little boy, why, when the time comes, I'll give you the 50 cents it takes to go see the circus, and you can go." And little boy, every day, would go down there and look at that poster, and in all the anticipation, and he would dream, and he had the enthusiasm, and he worked hard, and he did all the right things, and the father being a good father, when it come time, the circus to go, be in there while he gave the little boy the 50 cent piece. And the little boy, that Saturday morning, walked 5 miles to town. When he got to town, on the edge of town, like in the olden days, the circus used to come in on a train, and they'd set it up, and they'd put a big top down on the other end of town. And the day of the circus opening, while they'd come off of that train, and they'd put on their costumes, they'd get all the elephants and tigers and the animals, and they'd make a parade down through the center of the town. And the little boy sat on a curb because there they were in living color. He'd never seen anything before his entire life like it. He'd waited and waited and waited, and there it was. And he sits on that curb, and they all went by. And he was awestruck, and he couldn't believe his eyes because there it was in living color. And the last person in the parade was the clown. And when the clown went by, he tipped his hat. Little boy, being of no other knowledge, his ignorance was simplicity. He flipped his 50-cent piece up in the clown's hat. And he got up, and he walked 5 miles back home. And when he got home, his dad said, Did you see the circus? And the little boy said, yeah, I saw the circus. You see, that's a sad story. That's a sad story. That's not a happy story. Because the kid didn't see the circus. He saw the passing parade. And that's all Alcoholics Anonymous is, really, is a passing parade. I don't want to be a sad story. I've been a sad story all my life. I want to be a happy story. Man, I want the big top. This is the big top. Don't look for something that ain't here. This ain't a social thing. It's a matter of life and death. There is no competition here. It isn't a popularity contest. The last day of my detox, well, they put 39 of us in a circle, and they went around that circle, and they let everybody take each other's inventory, and 38 people said, I'm going to drink. Said, Keith's going to drink when he hits the street. They were so convincing that I damn near voted with them. I'm the only one out of 39 that's still sober. There's 7 dead suicides, 4 of those sober suicides because sobriety's so goddamn bad, they couldn't stand it. I don't want to be a sad story. I don't want to be a sad story. I've been a sad story all my life. I want to be a happy story. Man, I got up this morning, for the second I woke up this morning, this heartbeat right now. Sorry I woke you. I've been out on them streets, baby. I've been with the tall ones, the short ones, and the rich ones, and the poor ones. I've been with them all, man. I have been out there with them all day long. And the gift of this program, and the gift of a loving God is this. From the moment I woke up this morning to this heartbeat, right now, I haven't seen nobody or thought of anybody I'd rather be than me. God bless, and thank you.